Good morning. Yeah, it's good seeing all of your faces. I can't see you all. I can just see a few. Anyway, I hope you're all safe and well. Today, I'm going to talk, obviously, you know, I usually talk about practice, so I will continue with that. I'm going to talk about Seppo's turtle nose snake, which is case 24 of the Book of Equanimity. So, preface to the assembly, the carp of the eastern sea, the poison snake of the south mountain, the donkey's bray of Fuke, the dog's bark of Shiko, these do not fall into the commonplace. They do not behave like animals. Tell me, what is the conduct of such a person? The main case, attention. Seppo addressed the assembly saying, there's a poison snake on South Mountain. All of you had better take a look. Choke said, today in the Great Hall there are many who have lost their lives. A monk related this to Gensha, and Gensha remarked, only Dharma brother Choke could say that. But be that as it may, I'm not like that. The monks asked, what about you, Osho? Gensha said, why bother using South Mountain? Umon threw down a staff before Seppo and gave the appearance of being afraid. The appreciatory verse, Gensha's great vigor, Choke's small bravery, South Mountain's poison snake died uselessly. Where wind and clouds gather, the head sprouts horns. As expected, we see Umon take a hand and fiddle around. Amongst brilliant lightning flashes, see the change. When it's mine, I can let go or call back. When it's with him, he grabs and releases. What's right? Right now, can you give it to someone? His chill mouth rends them, but they don't feel the pain. I mean, it's kind of nice, you know. Zen practice, in general, there's an emphasis on realization. In the Soto school, you know, the manifesting of this enlightened life is very important. If we were to talk about Zen, you know, some people would say, yeah, it's about realization. Some people would say it's about social action. Some people would say it's about study. Some people would say it's about relationship. Some people would say it's about doing good deeds. You know, all of these things are important. We each have our own way, our own slant, our own, talents. And we also have our blind spots too as human beings. This emphasis of realization really is what we call the Buddha treasure. So if I were to put myself into the Buddha's shoes and see a sick person, an old person, what was the third one?
A dead person.
You know, then those same questions would arise for me. I mean, what is this life? You know, what's going on? That's the basis of the religion. Those may not be your questions. For me, that question was the slow burning question of why is there suffering? You know, so that was the thing for myself that I needed to solve. Some people don't have that, you know, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. It's not their makeup. I often go back to my Dharma sister who, you know, took the Buddha's words to heart, you know. Yeah, all beings are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. And, you know, I can't really say what was in her own mind, but on the outside, it apparently just seemed, yeah, I believe that, and I'm going to live in accord with that. and then continued to do that, be of service, do everything that was necessary as a human being. For some of us, you know, there's more the sense that, you know, I have to see this for myself. You know, maybe it's more philosophically based. You know, we have a great Western tradition of philosophy. But of course, it can't just be based on words. It, you know, it really needs to be based on direct experience. It doesn't work, you know, just to go, yeah, I think, therefore I am, and then just take it at that. You know, again, what do you do when you're not thinking? You're not, you know. So there's that aspect of really penetrating in. This has gone through the entire Zen tradition. This is a koan around that. Master Rinzai would say Zen is like rending wounds in healthy flesh. You know, then it's only then that you realize you have flesh, you know, in that way. But I mean, why is he bringing up such a thing? Why is he talking about snakes in this way? You know, the other night I came back and it was one of these hot nights that we've been having. And there was a rattlesnake just right in front of where I was going to park the car. So I sort of drove around it and then came back, and then Coco came over, and she's getting a little blind now. And so she was sort of startled. She was startled by this snake, you know, but she's a good mountain dog. She understands that you don't mess with rattlers. And most of the time they don't want to mess with you either. They only do that when you're threatening. So I went up and took a photograph of it. And it's a classic photograph of this snake, you know, just curled up and with its head just ready to strike. So, I mean, what does it mean to you? You know, Seppo here, he said this, just like, say, Steph says this or Tim says this. You know, we sort of sometimes bear these things in mind. On the South Mountain, or, you know, wherever you are, there's, in this case, he says turtle, no snake. It's probably a cobra. There's a cobra. If you haven't seen him yet, look. What does that mean to you? I mean, for many people, just go, okay, let's go looking for a snake. But that's not really what he's talking about. It's the thing that it kills, right? So it shows you. In Buddhism, we have this, or in Zen, we have this saying, die the great death. Or Hakuin would say, you know, die now and you never have to die again. Something that bites you goes right to the core. So you really see that self is forgotten. You know, like Dogen said, the self is forgotten. And in its entirety, you know, the self is forgotten. Whether it's self, others, everything included in that, the self is forgotten. That realization is the thing that gives us freedom. You know, even in the midst of fear and in difficulty, is that self-concern can be put on one side and you can function. You know, that's what that death of self really does as a human being. Plus, it shows you that thing that makes us all the same, this vast and empty, which is our birthright. And even in saying this, it makes me want to sort of spit out my words. Blah. You know. Just getting way too Zen. I mean, that's the beauty of it, though, is, again, we're just raising up something on the top to help us to appreciate the life that we have. You know, those words, in many ways, for some people, definitely, they're not needed. You know, but for others, it raises that up. It's like you suddenly become the fast horse. I really need to see that. I really need to realize that in the midst of my living. Now, Seppo has got some very good students. It's kind of interesting, you know, there's a story that Seppo really sort of embodied the aspect of training people and developing almost like a practice family. He was a very, what you would call the slow horse, you know, who was raised amongst many or a few geniuses, one of them being Ganto. And Ganto is like a spiritual genius, you know. So going back with this story, and I love this story, you know, he's going on pilgrimage with Ganto, his Dharma brother, who's already deeply realized and with a member of the Soto school. And they get snowed in up in the mountains, and they can't do anything. Basically, they've got enough food, they've got shelter, they've got fire. And Seppo, being gung-ho, he just starts sitting, and he just keeps on sitting and sitting. And Ganto, he's getting bored. He wants someone to talk to, And Seppo's just sitting, and he's... And Ganto eventually goes, "Okay, I've had enough." He goes, "What do you realize?" And you can imagine, this is a young guy. He's probably in his late 20s, early 30s, and Seppo's in his 40s. What do you realize? And so it's kind of insulting on one level. He goes, "Well, it's such and such a place, I realize the emptiness of all things." And Gantel's kind of, he's just like snorting, laughing. He goes, and "At so-and-so's place, I realize the interdependence of all things." And Gantel, he's just cracking up. And he goes, "Seppo, brother," he goes, "that which comes through the gate is not the family treasure." He says these words. Now, what does that mean? It means these things that come in from the outside, that's not the realization. Your life in itself, your basic awareness that functions moment and moment that you've had right from the beginning, is your life in itself. It's not these things that you come in and you have. Forget about that stuff. Anyway, apparently Seppo didn't, he had a little realization, I guess you could say. But he continued on practicing. And that's the beauty of Seppo, is that no matter what, he just kept at it. And so here you see him, now he's an abbot, and he's running a temple, and they say of about 1,500 monks, which you don't need to take that literally. It just means a lot. There are a lot there. But one of the beauties of Seppo was that they always, had a very deep practice context that was always there. And what he did, rather than foster competition amongst his students, he fostered a collaboration, basically, in terms of practicing together and then in terms of the hierarchy. But he also fostered them to test one another too, and he produced some of the most influential students in the Zen tradition, including Umon, Umon being the head of the Umon school, and Kyosei, Hofuku, Genshe, who was another spiritual genius. He was the fisherman that had his father die on a boat when he was out there with him. And as soon as he came in, then he immediately went into the monastery and started training. Within 2 years, he was realized, but he was a pretty modest character, but also very, very deep in his own realization. And these are some of the people in this particular case. I didn't mention Choke. He was another, genius in his own right. But we come back to this. There are many people in this hall who have been bitten by this snake, those that have really realized their own impermanence, that have died to themselves or died this great death that's being talked about. Choke just says that, there are many people in this hall who have died this great death. Period. Don't worry about that. Which is a very nice thing to tell your teacher. It's working. Don't worry. It's good coming from a student. I remember my Izumi Roshi once when we were talking about Mountain Center. He was looking at there's an old cedar tree on the just by the side of the road, probably about 100 yards, maybe 60 yards from the Buddha Hall. And he said, I hope this old cedar tree lasts another 300 years. And being young and stupid, I said, "Don't worry about that." Don't worry about that. I mean, again, you know, this is an analogy, but if you're aware of that analogy, it's not just the everyday language that is being used. You see behind it, what is he really concerned about? Maizumi Roshi was always concerned about the Dharma. You know, I knew he wasn't just talking about the cedar tree. Yeah. So now it's in our hands. Don't worry about that. Make sure that that lives, you know. And again, that heart of Buddhism, that heart continues. And it's important to do the work that makes that heart continue. It's not the buildings or the grounds, you know. It's that living realization. Everything else supports the Dharma in one way or another, you know. That in many ways, I don't even like using the word Dharma, the truth. The teachings of the truth, the teachings of reality that are manifesting on a momentary basis, being in accord with this. So you can see, you know, Choke's words, he's insightful. You know, he can see the difference. He can just see the difference between shit and shinola. He just uses his eyes, uses his ears, and then it becomes apparent what is there in front of him. You know, again, is... In the Zen school, we tend to get a little bit in-house with these things, but if you come back at the stories, but one of the beauties is that these stories are like scenarios that happen in our lives. It's not that I'm just interested in the koans. The koans are just a good springboard to start off looking into the nature of things. Again, with many religions, it's just take the words that have already been said and believe them, and you're okay. You know, that may be true for some people, but, you know, it's like for myself, if I put my life in a Christian context, I was more like St. Thomas. You know, I had to put my hand in the wound first and see if it's real, you know. Does he come back? Oh, looks like it. You know, until that, it really is a reality in that case. In terms of the practice of Buddhism, the spirit of it is so important. The entering into difficulties is important. Being able to sit long and hard, being able to go into difficulties of making sure that the teaching continues, being sure that the place that the practice is safe and well. All of those things are far more important than just one's own self-relation that tends to preoccupy most people on this planet. This thing that's always there, this thing that irks us on a momentary basis, the words of these ancients that come in, what are they talking about? Ultimately, it just comes back to this, you know, this moment in time, this place, all of these things. But if you are anchored in this, it doesn't really matter how they say it, you understand in one way or another, because your mind is around this. It's not about practicing how it will be when, you know, I become greatly enlightened, or, you know, I get some respect, or flowers fall. You know, you might like more of that kind of thing. You know, but, you know, again, as they quite often say in the koans, but flowers falling becomes messy in time, and then you got to clean that up. No matter what rewards you get, you got to clean that up at some point. Okay, so the next one. He relates this to Genshe. I was telling you about the fisherman who became a monk. And Genshe replied, only Dharma brother Choke could say that. But be that as it may, I'm not like that. You know, I'm not him. I can't say that. It's like with my Dharma brothers. They say certain things. It would be an insult for me to them to just agree with what they said, you know. I've got to say it from my own standpoint, my own direct experience. Then that's far more important, whether it's better or worse. It doesn't really matter, but it's a true experience in that way. So he said, the monk then said, well, what about you, priest? And he goes, why bother about using South Mountain? So he goes, on the South Mountain, there is a snake. You'd better look for it. So why, he goes, why bother using South Mountain? You know, here we have mountains in the, actually, we don't have one on the south. We have one on the north, east, and west. And then we have one way to the south. So we would say on this mountain. Or why can't we say on Apple Canyon? Or why can't we say, I'm looking at Dan in Los Angeles, you know, or with Tom, looking wherever you are, yeah, on this place, or Asher in Barrow in England, you know, yeah, on this Barrow, there is a poisonous snake. This thing that cuts through everything. It's kind of interesting. You know, I remember when my son was bitten by a snake. There was the immediate concern of death. Obviously for me, but I couldn't do an awful lot about it. He could. You know, it really brings up the beauty of living in itself. All that value. You know, that's the thing that really bites us. It's not the fear of death. The thing that is the cure for that bite is the appreciation of living in itself and knowing that living is so tenuous. You know, can I really appreciate it? You know, it's not avoidance of it, but it's really seeing that value. And then, you know, when I say that, it's not just my life, it's just seeing it around you. Everything that's there. And I'm not saying just, you know, because I'm out in the country. When I was in LA, it was like that. Tremendous beauty wherever you go. You know? And the thing is, then also look at that, is where do we draw the line between this and that? You know, and you see these acts, natural acts of compassion out in the world. People will just naturally just respond. Somebody's about to fall, you catch them. You know, you see somebody who's sick and you help them along. But it's natural. It's not, well, I'm being compassionate now, you know. No, I see that their life and my life are like that. When I see a person that is older than me, is that I have respect for that. I'll be there soon. You know, I've always had that since I was a kid. You know, I'll be there soon. So I watch how people live. Some people I'm, you know, I want to be like that when I grow up, you know. I don't know when I will grow up, but, you know, at some point. So why use South Mountain? It's imminent. That's the most important thing here. So we get into Umon. Now, you got to realize at this point in Umon's life, he's pretty young, you know, so he's a young shaver in his 20s. And but he's also very precocious and highly realized. But this is the way that he expresses himself at this point. So Umon, you know, he just cuts through everything and throws his staff down and, you know, makes a gesture of fright. Yeah, it's here. He's very lively in that respect. But don't take it he's being zen. He's just showing the, you know, he's here, he's now. No other place, no other time. In another koan, it's kind of interesting because obviously Umon becomes very subtle in his older age. And one of the commentators, it might have been Secho, he says, for what you did as a youth, aren't you ashamed? You know, so Umon would have been a lot more subtle, you know. He might go, what are you looking for? What else are you looking for? Imagine something verbal like that, he probably would have said. You know, what are you talking about? Why are you raising all this stuff up, you know? When you were younger, aren't you ashamed? Like all those activities that I did as a kid, you know, as a young practitioner, all of that extra work that I made for myself and people around me, all of the drama that I went through, by not being enlightened, being enlightened, missing something, gaining something, all of that stuff. Aren't you ashamed? Yes, I confess, I'm ashamed. But so what? You know, this is life. You can't help being who you are at whatever time. It's not better or worse. It cannot be other than it is. You know, I can't go back and change things in that way. But it's, you know, it's just beautiful in that sense. But again, what I'm emphasizing here is this core of our own practice. And then one, you know, the major thing that Koan brings up is it's not just take it as that these were words that were said 1,000 years ago. You know, so what does that human being mean, whether they exist now or not? You know, just in the same way as that I may look into something that was done in the Roman era, some words that were said, and why did they say that? In the context of today, it may seem really odd, you know, but then I look into that and see why they actually said it. You know, maybe I have to do some background reading. Maybe I have to talk with somebody that knows about that stuff. You know, and it's the same way if somebody comes and expresses the Dharma in a certain way, then I look at them and I ask questions. Why do you say that? What's going on there? If they want me to do the work, then I can, you know. But that's the important thing. It's that living aspect now. Don't take it that these things were done at that time. They've been passed down because they were important to some people. You know, they were important to some people. Now that importance, again, then raises up this aspect of vast, empty, our own birthright, the appreciation of life. Those things you can't lose by going into those things and learning in the midst of them, to immerse for a period of time. Really allow those things to be embodied in such a way that you never forget it. You know, just like doing a sport, just like playing guitar, it gets embodied. You never forget it. And so, you know, I'd like to, if I'm saying anything, it's these last words. This is the most important thing. Everything else arises out of that. So at this point, I'd like to open it up for any questions or comments, and then I will continue if not.
So you can unmute yourself if you'd like now. You can also use the raise hand feature. And I have opened up chat as well. Winston, go ahead.
Hey, Winston, carry on.
Hi.
Hi.
I would think I've been sitting for kind of inconsistently for a few years. And I've been reading, I think I'm reading a book by Charlotte Joko Beck, I think is
her name. Yeah, my Dharma sister.
Okay. I'd like to know if, my sitting right now consists of like sitting in chunks, like 3 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes and stuff. Is there anything you could recommend that I, in a way, just suggestions for like a deeper practice or like any recommendations or anything like that?
Well, the first thing is know your own pace. You know, so you don't want to do too much. Otherwise, it might put you off. So try and develop it over a period of time. You know, I'd say, you know, if you can work up to about half an hour over a year or something, then try that. Because that stillness, you know, begins to, the physical stillness, if you can do that, it begins to permeate the rest of your life. And then that stillness then is, it slows the mind so we don't just have knee-jerk reactions so easily.
When you say 30 minutes, do you mean like at a time, you mean?
Well, I'm saying work up to it at your own pace. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not that intimidating. Don't worry. You know, it's just, it's like for myself, when I first started, I was really hyper. I was a very active kid. I started when I was about 19. And I could only sit for 3 minutes because it was way too boring, you know. And so But I was drawn back to doing sit-in. I didn't have a teacher or anything like that because I didn't even know about Buddhism at the time. I just heard about meditation. And so I sat and I was going, I really don't like this, but there's something about it that feels right. So then I sat at that kind of pace for a while, and then I began to work it up to about 10 minutes, over a few months. And then that began to work. And then after probably about 4 or 5 months, I decided that I would have a bus passing my house every 10 minutes. And so I didn't have to keep looking at the clock and seeing how long I was sitting. I would just get up when the bus came around. And then one day the bus broke down. And so I ended up sitting for 20 minutes. And then from then it was fairly straightforward. It was fairly easy, But don't worry about time so much. It's more the quality of that sitting. And you're far better off sitting there for a time that really works for you. And then really sitting with wholeheartedly in that period, putting thought on one side. And the reason you put thought on one side is so that your experience of reality is not contingent on thinking. We're all already really good at thinking, but we're not so good at just direct experiencing, especially if something is, there's nothing going on.
Thank you. And if I could ask one other question, what's the importance of having a teacher?
They're like a catalyst, They just stimulate you. And for me, is I always felt I had to bring something up when I went to the teacher. So then what I had to do was, practice in such a way that then I would bring up something that would help. And the teacher also will help you with stuff like, we read all kinds of stuff, and some of it isn't that great. And they'll kind of go, well, you should really watch out about that, because it's not, it's not really going to be helpful in the long run. Or you could look at it in a different way. It's like, for myself, my trade was I was a joiner or a carpenter. And so I wanted to know carpentry to the hilt. I really wanted to know it so I could become the best that I could be. And the carpentry teachers that I picked were the best that I could find. And so they taught me to the best. So don't look for somebody that, doesn't have a very good reputation, because usually they'll have a lower standard too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Winston. Bruce.
Hello.
Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Patrick.
Los Angeles, hey?
Back in black.
Yeah.
Back no, you're not. Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, last week I was at my house and my internet was messing around.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just wanted to say hi. I was working at my house last week and I was reflecting that, that kind of physical work where you don't think much,
mm-hmm.
type of thing is, it's really nice when practice is just what you're doing.
Yeah.
Cause you can get things done.
Yeah.
But it's not like, oh, I should be doing this, or I should be, meditating on this or thinking about this. It's just like, oh, whatever is happening is what's happening. And it's kind of nice that way. Then it's just like, okay.
Yeah.
Usually that doesn't work for me though. I'm always keyed to, whatever.
Hey, your hand's in the way. I can't quite. Oh. Yeah, that's better. Thanks. I'm not talking to the hand, And again, it's good to, like you're saying, it's good to do that simple stuff so that you can sort of absorb into that. But also, don't put thought into a shadow. Use it as a tool where you have to as well. You know, because that's right. Also important. I'm not saying use it as an entertainment device all the time, you know, but use it as a tool to cut through things. Yeah. There was another phrase that I was going to use from Korean Zen, which is by a master I really admire called Chinul. And, you know, he would use the phrase tracing back the radiance, which is great. You know, I mean, each one of us has our own radiance, and thought is one of those things, is that, so if we propose something in ourselves, is where does that come from? You know, you cut it away so it doesn't just run on automatic, and you keep tracing this back. And it's the same with thought, is if you've put in out a whole, like a cloud of thought, is that, okay, trace that back to where you stand. And then thought becomes more of a tool that you use. It cuts through itself, you know, in many ways.
I see.
Yeah. And that, you know, I mean, that's one of the so-called methods of Zen. I mean, here is that when somebody brings up life and death, then that kind of wakes me up, you know. So,
right.
So then that goes, what is this? You know, that tracing back the radiance, it comes back to that. And it's important to keep things simple in that respect. It usually gets rid of a layer of suffering where we're trying to receive something from the outside, you know, or expectations about the world. And that just cuts back to, you know, what I am right now, that snake that's there.
For me, a lot of those things are difficult. I've been noticing that when I acknowledge, when I acknowledge the voices that I don't really want to,
mm-hmm.
Or basically acknowledge things about myself that I don't really like or want to.
Yeah.
Somehow it's just that acknowledging kind of frees things up,
yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't even know how it works, but I'm kind of glad it works, because usually I'm the other way, where I'll use any tool I possibly can to get rid of those things.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and it helps, you know, when you see things as they are, then quite often is the taboo is lost. And so, you know, there's usually a pull to those things, you know, from the side if you've sort of buried them. You know, I'm not going to go there. You let them out, you see them for what they are, their power quite often is diminished in that respect.
Yeah, when people say, see things as they are.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this as it is, mm-hmm. in my mind, there's always a but.
Yeah. But the butt's always behind you.
You know, not the.
Yeah.
You know, well,
Yeah, and that's important. Is that but important? You know, that's the thing. Is that examine that too. Is it true? Is this true in the context of this moment in time? Is it true? And quite often is that that's just a line of thought that we've used as a default mechanism for a period of time. You know, and again, if you bring that out into the open, is quite often you see that it's not that important. You know, it's not real. Like, it can be let go of for now. And so then the mind on some levels can relax.
Yeah, for me, you were talking about that story, which I love, about the, you know, Seppo and, was it Ganto?
Yeah.
You know, hanging out. And there's a line in there where Seppo is just basically, well, you know, I practice because I'm not comfortable with myself, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you can make fun of me. And, at first, like, Seppo's kind of telling Ganto, what's wrong with you, man? You just, you know, we're monks and all you're doing is sleeping all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
He should be meditating like me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then he turns around where he's just kind of like, you're probably right, but I don't feel comfortable with myself. What else can I do? You know, what am I supposed to do? And then Ganto helps him, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And then help, you know, for me comes in looking at those places where I figured running away from there was the way to go, you know? That's where you've helped me out a lot, you know?
Oh, so thanks.
I appreciate it a lot.
So, well, yeah, really, you know, we're Dharma brothers under Maizumi Roshi. What can I do? You know?
Yeah. We got that going for us.
Got that going for us. Yeah. Fucker. Take care, eh?
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Jill, go ahead.
Hi, Tenshin.
Hi.
Hi, Jill. It's Jill from Los Angeles. So I had a question about the Four Noble Truths, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So what I like to do just for myself is kind of take in a little bit of Zen at a time and then just process it. Through sitting and apply it to my everyday life constantly and see if it rings true. And then if it does, I sort of absorb it. And so the first noble truth was clear for me. And the second one about, the first one is that there's suffering.
Yeah. And so then the second your translation is there is suffering. Okay. That's the translation.
Yeah, that's my translation.
Yeah. Okay, great.
That's my translation. Yeah.
Good.
And it worked for me. And then the second one about suffering is caused by the attachment to things and notions. So I worked on that one for a long time, and it's absolutely 100% correct for me.
Yeah.
So now I want to dive into number three, the Eightfold Path. But it seems there's a lot there, and I just haven't gone into it yet. And so I wanted to know, it just seems like a lot because there's eight things and then how to apply them. And
well,
I just wanted you to maybe give me some guidance on that, on the third one.
Yeah. I mean, it can be taken, and quite often in the Theravadan school, it'll be taken as eight separate things. Now in Zen practice, it is a path. And it's all based on the first one, which is right thought or view. So if it's right thought, think about this, experience this. If it's view, see things as they are. So that's the basis, and that goes from number one to number eight.
Could you expand on that, the first one, the right point of view?
Okay. So what are you seeing now?
Wait, say that again.
What are you seeing now? Yeah, so stay.
I mean, I see people, but I'm also seeing. Yeah.
Stay here.
My life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now when you say your life, make sure it's living and not something abstract called life. So everything comes back to this moment in time, this direct experience. Okay, now then we go up to the second one, which is. I think it's right intention.
Okay.
So then the intention is see things as they are. That's my intention.
Okay.
If you have that intention, basically it's preparing your mind. The first three are really about preparing your mind in terms of practice and rooting it in one place. Okay. So I really want to do this. I'm going to do it. The third one is right speech. Now, in terms of a path, is commitment. I'm going to do it. So in terms of a path, it's commitment. You know, it's not just I'm going to be nice to people and speak nice things. It's like I am committed to seeing things as they are. I'm going to do that. So if you look at your life quite often, if you're going to do something that is important to you, you'll think about it in this way. You know, I want to do this. This is how I'm going to do it. And I'm going to, and I'll even tell people I'm going to do it. Because as soon as I open it up to other people, it's that then I've got some support. Because they'll, you know, they'll go, well, you're a procrastinator if you don't, if you don't do it.
The accountability. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Accountability. And then the fourth one, sort of like right thought or view, right intention, right speech, and then right act. Is it right? Yeah, right action. So actually then doing something about it. So now I am doing, being present to my life. I am doing that. I'm practicing that. So that's four. Okay. Now the fifth one is right livelihood. Now, right livelihood doesn't just mean, well, I'm not going to be a butcher. I'm not going to be an executioner. I'm not going to do those things. It means that I am going to take being this into all spheres of livelihood. So relationship, work, socializing, being alone in whatever I do. Everything that I do, there's no escape, basically. I'm going to take it. There's no excuse, no escape. That's livelihood across the board. Okay, so then...
I don't have it written. Discipline.
Yeah.
Discipline.
I maybe you're doing a different translation than one. Discipline.
It's in your book that you wrote.
I lied. What the? Discipline. God, you put me on the spot now.
Damn. Okay, you don't. You
no, just a minute. No, discipline.
Just like,
well, again, well,
them.
Well,
discipline.
No, but discipline, right? What's discipline to you? Because with a lot of people think that discipline is, you know, using the whip, etc. You know, whereas for me, discipline is I want to do this, therefore I'm going to do it no matter what. So that then you've got more an aspect here of doing something over and over, which is what that is. There's another word that I used for this one, which was better. And I just, right now I can't think of it. It wasn't mindfulness. There was another one for it, which I quite often use. Anyway, I'll use discipline. It's there.
Effort.
Yeah, there you go. Effort.
Okay.
Now. Okay. So
I like that
go
word.
Back to, yeah. So, Right effort, which I'm not sure what translation I was using, but it's kind of interesting that effort comes at this point, because you've put it into all spheres of livelihood, is that it can no longer be efforting towards something else. That effort has to come back. What is this? How what is going on? What life is this that I have? And it's like Master Dogen said, to take the backward step that turns one's light inwardly and illumines the self. So it's like, you know, like if you take a step back, you know, it's more like you come back to where you are in that way. So you look at what this is. You're no longer looking to when you become something else in the future. So all the effort is gathered into this place. There's no other time or place. Okay, now the last two are a bit easier because there's only two left. The next one is right mindfulness. And this is kind of interesting because usually mindfulness, you would think it would be from the beginning. But from this perspective, in terms of a path, and this is kind of interesting, the mind is full. Not the brain, the mind. In Buddhism, mind means the whole shebang. Everything is included in this. The mind is full, so where are you going to go? It's all here. That's an amazing experience, amazing feeling. There's no other place to go. is all here. So in terms of a path, you can see, you know, sequentially, it's brilliant. You know, do it this way. Everything's here. The whole practice is here. And then the last one, right samadhi. Now, you know, people use samadhi very loosely, like it's a concentration that's just developed in and just resides in meditation. But samadhi means basically oneness doing or oneness actualized. That's samadhi. So there's the samadhi of play they often talk about. You know, there's the samadhi of when you're lost in doing things. There's the samadhi of meditation. There's the samadhi of relationship. There's not a separation there. It's just this is what's going on, nothing else. And so you've got like, but it really is, it's number one, you know, being here. And then that last one is manifested. You realize that number one and number eight are not two things. The only thing is that the thought process is no longer dominant. It hasn't been diminished in any way. It's just that direct experience is now dominant. And we can think about it and we can use thought as a wonderful tool to express. So there you go. All eight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah. There you go. Phew.
Thanks, Jill.
Thank you, Jill.
Ellen, if you want to unmute yourself, her roommate Roma would like to say something.
Great.
I'm on.
You are. No, you're not. I can't see you. Hi. I can't see you, but never mind. Yeah.
I feel like that you've spoken to my roommate and myself directly in this talk because one of our dogs got bit by a rattlesnake this week.
Yeah.
And everything that was done in the moment.
Yeah.
It wasn't, oh, we have to think about this. What should we do? Mm-hmm. We should probably take him to the vet. We should probably, you know, find out how much it's going to cost.
Yeah.
There were no questions there. It was it was all in each moment. And I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's true. It's, you know, when Nick was bitten, you know, I did all the things that you shouldn't do, but it was just instinctive, you know, try to suck the venom out, you know, and then, try to put I wouldn't say a tourniquet, just put pressure on there. And then I, you know, went off and took him to the, the paramedics, and they said, no, just keep him quiet, you know. The interesting thing was I spat the venom out into a glass, and then when I came back, it changed color. So there was something going on there, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. But that's it. You know, it's that instinct is you that kicks in. If you don't get in the way, then usually, you know, the person's taken care of.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the worry over the top that gets in the way quite often.
That's right. And thank God and Buddha.
Yeah. They're not two, by the way.
Oh, yeah. They're all one. I understand that more than anything.
Good. Yeah.
But thank you for this talk today. It really hit me right where it needed to hit me.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Alan. Thomas Boynton.
Hello, Roshi. How are
Tom.
Sir?
Yeah, good seeing you.
Say, I'm dealing with a difficult koan, and this might be better in private, Doksan, but let's give it a go. I'm not real good at this, but in my practice right now, my present wife of 12 years is going through the same cancer that killed my first wife of 23 years, ovarian cancer. And we've been having some pretty dark days in April. Things are looking better at the moment.
Yeah.
On one hand, I have that. On the other hand, and on that side, maybe we put the pandemic, and now we have this smoke that smells like bacon.
Yeah.
And the things are happening to us. And what's coming to my mind is, it's always been this way, hasn't it? I mean, is that what you mean? Civilizations have come and gone. Things go on. The sun's going to rise. Mm-hmm. And the other side of me says, life is fabulous. I mean, here where I am, I'm so grateful. Yeah. I have this beautiful little garden to hang out in. And I realize that life is moment to moment. Yes, there's death.
Yeah. And that... And
I know I'm also sitting on a drum of upsetness, sadness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You tap into that from time to time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering, is my present consciousness blowing smoke up my ass?
Have you got your pants on?
Yeah,
good. They're probably not blowing smoke up your ass. The important thing here is be the container for all of these experiences.
Okay.
You know, and obviously when I'm in the midst of something, that occupies most of the space.
Yeah.
And it's important to let it do that. But like you're saying, is that no matter what's going on, is that you're alive and kicking, and there's tremendous beauty around. You know, it's usually the story that we follow that takes us away from whatever it is that's here. And the direct experience of something helps us to process whatever is going on. But if we sort of push it away, it's not being experienced. So it tends to come back in a stronger way. If you experience it as it goes on. But the second thing with this is that it has its own season. It's not your season. You know, so don't will it to go. Is be in it, experience it, and then tremendous experience and depth comes out of that, because these things are not easy to go through. You know?
And, you know, one more thing. One of the challenges for me is I know how it ended up with Tamaki.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we all know how it's going to end up for us.
Yeah.
But part of my mind is just kind of caught up in trying to, okay, what am I going to do? Am I going to do, where am I going to live? What's going to happen? That feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And those things are natural, but don't lose sight of that basic one. You know, is know that, you know, it's like we're all going to die, you know? But the thing is, how do I live in the midst of this? And if the focus is on that, it's a lot easier to live than on the worrying. And I'm just saying that from my own experience. It was, you know, it's like after the fires, you know, we were in such a, there was a very dire financial thing at that point. I could dwell in that, or I could get on with what I could do and try and appreciate the life that I had, no matter what was going, was, you know, the amount of work or the worry that was going on. If I focused on that, then I could take care of it. But if my mind just dwelled in the worry, you know, it's endless. And you don't really deal with it on that way, you know.
And there is no future, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we say that. I don't know if we believe it, but, you know.
We don't. Anyway, I want to just say I love you, buddy.
Yeah, you too, Tom. You take care, eh?
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Got one last minute if anyone has a quick question.
Question or comment, yeah. All right, no one?
No, Lena.
All right, Lena, carry on.
Hi, it's just wonderful to be with everyone every Sunday. I love this. I just, what came to mind, and I'm not trying to be smart here, but what came to mind is one of my favorite things that happens at the end of, I guess, a week of session. It's the, and I don't know if I can even say it correctly, but let me respectfully remind you, life yeah. and death are of supreme importance. I had a feeling that that's what you were talking about this morning. I may
yeah.
be correct, yeah. but just appreciating our life.
Yeah.
Whatever's going on.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very Mr. Rogers-y, doesn't it, in that way. But, you know, the beauty of living is really something. Or nothing.
As Mr. Rogers, whenever I hear that said, I get chills. I mean, I really do. It just yeah. it goes right to my gut. It just,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so. Maybe that's Mr. Rogers. He was a pretty neat guy. So
he was, yeah, yeah. yeah.
But, thank you.
All right, thank you. Oh, and my yeah, with Tom, stay safe with those fires up there. Mm. Yeah, I feel for you. I understand on that level. We've been watching for lightning too, you know? Yeah.
Well, it's nothing compared to what you've gone through, my friend. But no. thank you for good wishes and to yeah.
All right.
All right. Thank Take you, care. Everyone. Just a quick wrap up here. We have our online store is now available and open for business. That's zmc.org/store. We have temple items, books, apparel, statues. So please have a look. If there's anything else you're interested in, please let us know. As usual, zmc.org/donate if you feel inspired and able to. And I think mm-hmm. we have a few more Sundays before training period begins. So we hope to see you next week. Please stay safe.